Welcome to Better Sex, where you get the information and inspiration to create and enjoy your best possible sex life. Join your host, sex therapist Jessa Zimmerman, as she brings you expert guests, helpful tips, knowledge, and strategies to improve your intimate relationships. And now, your host, Jessa Zimmerman.
Hey, it's Jessa. Welcome back to another episode of the Better Sex Podcast. And we are talking today about endometriosis. And I'm talking to Dr. Allison Shrikande, who runs Pelvic Rehabilitation Medicine, which is really dedicated to helping women with pelvic pain. Well, people with pelvic pain. But she's got a real concern and interest and involved in research around endometriosis. So we're talking about what it is, how common it is, give you a hint, it's at least 1 in 10 women, how it shows up, what are the treatment options, and how can her clinic help pre or post-surgery too. So anyway, it's worth listening to because even if you don't have endometriosis, if it's at least 1 in 10 women, someone you know does. And this could be useful to have the awareness and the understanding and be prepared to be helpful if it ever comes up. I hope you get a lot out of it. And before we start the show today, it is sponsored by Intimacy with Ease. It's a method to help otherwise happy couples achieve a sex life that is easy and fun for both of them so that you can actually just enjoy your sex life with zero stress. For more information, if you want to watch a brief little training video that's available, all of that, go to intimacywithease.com. So, Dr. Shrikande, right? Allison, yes. Thank you so much for joining me. I have been looking to talk to somebody about endometriosis for quite a long time. So I am so excited to have found you and to be having this conversation.
Thank you, Jessica. Thank you so much for having me on this fabulous podcast. You're doing amazing work and I'm excited to be here.
Well, thank you. So could we just start with what is endometriosis? How common is it? You know, maybe people have heard the word and unless somebody's struggling with it, they may not be totally clear about what it is.
Yeah, sure. Endometriosis is when there are cells that are similar to the cells that line the uterus. These cells are found outside the uterus, and they can be found really anywhere. I mean, most commonly in the pelvic cavity, but they can leave the pelvic cavity and go to the diaphragm, so they can really be found anywhere. And essentially what happens is because they are cells that are similar to the lining of the uterus, you know, when there's the patients have their menstrual cycle, so they act very similar. So they, you know, they bleed and there can be some inflammation and then kind of healing. And the healing can be almost like sticky scar tissue. And that process happens over and over again. And overall, it is a pro-inflammatory systemic disease process.
And you say similar, I guess. Okay, so that corrects something for me right away, because for some reason I thought it was sort of like the same thing as, you know, the lining of the uterus was somehow growing somewhere else. But you're saying no, it's not like those cells somehow migrated.
Not necessarily. There is, you know, some kind of debate in the medical community, but no, definitely the definition is cells that are similar to the lining of the uterus.
Okay. And how common is this?
Yeah, it's very common. So it's depending on the study, it's either 1 in 10 women or 1 in 9 women. So it's just as common, if not more common than breast cancer. Yeah, so it's very common. And there is a strong genetic predisposition that we see for sure. But overall, we are still really learning about the disease process, honestly. And the challenge with endometriosis, you know, we call it the silent disease, right? So it can be, you know, very challenging to diagnose. The average kind of time to diagnosis and right now is 6.7 years of symptoms before patients get a proper kind of diagnosis of endometriosis.
Okay. So as always, I have so many questions. So let's start with symptoms. I mean, I'm sort of imagining that if 1 in 9 or 1 in 10 women have this, is that just the symptomatic ones? Or do we all have, you know, I'm a woman, do we all have these cells and they just don't cause problems? Like what are the symptoms? When does it become problematic? How does somebody know?
Well, that is an excellent question because it is such a spectrum of symptoms that we, you know, we are, again, still learning. The way it presents is either it can present as infertility or pelvic pain, and sometimes both, and sometimes just one. So that's kind of how it is. Sometimes we have them coming together. And in terms of pelvic pain, the classic is what we see at pelvic rehabilitation. It's that sling. So it's the sling in your pelvis. A lot of times it's associated with pain with intercourse is very common, or pain with tampon use or speculum exam if patients have not had intercourse yet. Urinary urgency, frequency, sensation of UTI that never went away. And then bowels, a lot of GI and bowel complaints, constipation, pain with bowel movement, abdominal bloating. Sometimes you can have actually during your menstrual cycle, you can have some blood in your stool because you're menstruating and the cells went more posterior towards the rectum. So that's it. And then a lot of pelvic pain, a lower abdominal pain, radiating to the buttocks or sacrum or low back pain, classically worse with your menstrual cycle. But sometimes if it's been there for a long time, it just becomes your normal. So I'd say the most common is pain with intercourse or soreness after. It's probably the most common, but we see all of those symptoms.
Yeah, and they sound like so many other things, right? Like this
that's
is
the problem. That's right. There's a lot going on in the pelvis. There's so many different organ systems, right? And there's also all this crosstalk that they all talk to one another and upregulate one another. So they're all very close friends that talk to each other too much.
So. Okay. And I guess I had, again, had the impression that a lot of the pain from endo would be sort of deep interior pain. But you're saying, no, it could be sort of anywhere around the whole lower region, right? Like it's...
Right. It just depends on it, right? Where it went, the severity. But yeah, classically with endometriosis, deep disc hernia, we call it. So pain with intercourse, but more classically more deep on deep penetration. But sometimes it's both, right? So it can be both deep and superficial, given the involvement of the different nerves of the pelvis that are often involved with endometriosis.
Right. And like you're saying, the crosstalk and everything. And then you said it can show up as infertility. So here's another thing I didn't know is that it's related to infertility.
It is. Yes.
How does that work or not work? Like what's the process by which it's interfering with fertility?
Well, it's interfering with fertility, multiple reasons. The two main would be sometimes it can be a mechanical almost blockage, right? So if these kind of endometriosis cells, which get inflamed and then become sticky scar tissue, it can get in the way near the fallopian tube. So that can be more of a mechanical sort of issue, kind of a block. So that's one reason why infertility. Another reason, sometimes with endometriosis, you can get something called a endometrioma or chocolate cyst on the ovaries. So that may affect fertility as well. Also, endometriosis is a, as we mentioned, like a pro-inflammatory disease state. So what it does is it promotes this pro-inflammatory soup with these cytokines that inflame the nerves and also just have a lot of inflammation around the pelvic organs and structures. And that may be associated with infertility as well. That inflammation is challenging to implant in the inflammation. Those are some reasons. And then there's also some hormonal effects of endometriosis as well that can affect what we call the HPA axis and hormones. There are multiple reasons.
Yeah. Well, and then if sex is painful, right, that could potentially get in the way too, right? It sounds like it shows up in so many different ways. You know, like it's not a simple thing, right? How is it diagnosed? Like, is there a definitive test? Like, yes, this is what's going on. How do you figure out that that's what's happening?
At this point in time, currently the gold standard for diagnosis is surgery. So it's a laparoscopic surgery. And for you send pathology, you send to path. You get some cells and you send to pathology and that will confirm the endometriosis. So that is currently the gold standard. There are multiple brilliant people, geneticists and multiple different groups working on other ways to potentially diagnose endometriosis at pelvic rehabilitation medicine. We are involved with the ROSE trial, Research Outsmarts Endometriosis. And we, Drs. Gregerson and Metz out of the Feinstein Medical Institute are leading this project where they're analyzing the menstrual effluent of patients for the biomarkers to see if there's some sort of similarity that they can help identify endometriosis via this menstrual effluent. Some people are looking at different blood tests. There's more and more awareness in the past year or two, which is great. More money going towards research to help find a diagnostic.
Yeah. if it's mostly diagnosed through surgery, how do you know where to look? I mean, you're sort of talking about it could be anywhere in the cavity. Like those cells could be in so many places. Do you just sort of start looking all around, or are you able to localize based on where someone is having pain? Or
well, that's also another great question. So that is a challenge. So that's why it really behooves patients to go to really a surgeon who is an expert in endometriosis excision. And that is what they do all day, every day, because it is a challenging disease process. So that is kind of the number one thing is find a surgeon, either look on iCare Better or Nancy's Nook. These are great spots for expert endometriosis surgeons in the country who really know it. That makes a big difference to figure out where, to know where to look, you just have to be doing it all day, every day, and really be highly trained. You know what crevets to look in, and some people use certain dyes and just know where to look. And then not only finding it is a challenge, but then you really have to properly treat it. So excise it and just know how to treat it. And it can be challenging. So yes, that is the secret, is to go to a surgeon who is really focused on endometriosis.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what the treatment options are. I mean, so surgery is one where you're just trying to excise all the sticky healing tissue. Is that what gets removed?
That's correct. Yep, that is what would get removed, is the actual endometriosis. That is definitely what will get removed. And then it depends on the patient. You could try to preserve the ovaries and or the uterus as well. Just depends on the patient's age and what they're looking to do in life and et cetera. But yeah, the key is to just get those endometriosis, the plaques out properly.
Okay. Is there any other treatment option besides surgical removal? Or is that pretty much what the option is?
Well, there's hormonal options as well. And sometimes it's to suppress the endometriosis because it is an estrogen-dependent disease process. So sometimes the hormonal options can have significant side effects, though, and put you into early menopause and have their own side effects. And sometimes you do both. It's a complicated disease process. So quite often it's both a surgery and then post-op, maybe hormonal suppression of some sort, or maybe an IUD for oral birth control. So that's kind of a discussion with your surgeon. And then at Pelvic Rehabilitation Medicine, we treat endometriosis as well, either pre-op if you're, or post-op after the surgery. And what we're doing is treating that residual inflammation around the peripheral nerves and that muscle spasm that comes with chronic guarding that can, and as well as the central sensitization. So that central nervous system's turned up with endometriosis and chronic pain. So we calm all that down, usually after a surgery, sometimes before, if the patient's trying to avoid a surgery. But yeah, that's what kind of our role is to really treat that inflammation and muscle spasms that really contribute to a lot of the symptoms, pain with intercourse, et cetera. And the pain and discomfort can come from a lot of the nerve pain.
Yeah. Hey, just a quick little break in the show because I have something to offer you. If you have ever sat with your partner and you kind of run out of things to talk about that are not, work, the kids, money, logistics, who's doing what, what's happening this weekend. If you are looking for a deeper way to connect, have conversations that build intimacy, that build awareness, of yourself and your partner, I have daily conversation starters for you. You'll get them via text message every day, and then the two of you can have a more interesting conversation than maybe what you've been doing. All you have to do is text me the word topics to 206-309-8645, or look in the show notes. There's a link there. But text me the word topics, and you will start getting those every day. Now back to the show. And I've heard anecdotally that you can have the surgery, but then the tissues are going to recur, or it can, right? Is this the kind of thing that's a chronic condition for a woman throughout her life and occasionally has to go in and get the tissue, the endometriosis excised, or is this sort of a one and done kind of situation?
It technically is a chronic disease process, and the recurrence rate really just depends also on the surgeon, right? It's the surgery, what was done, exactly. Was it an excision or an ablation and the surgery? So technically can always recur, even with the best surgeons,
yeah.
But it doesn't always have to. It's such a spectrum. I've seen it across the spectrum where, it really just depends. Sometimes one surgery is sufficient with, some post-op kind of physical therapy and some pelvic floor rehab with a physiatrist, and you're good to go, honestly. And sometimes not. It really depends on the patient.
Yeah. And you mentioned something about preserving the ovaries or the uterus. So sometimes the best choice is to remove organs, sounds like.
This depends. With endometriosis, sometimes you sometimes also have adenomyosis, which is within the uterus. So sometimes they do. But if it's standard endometriosis and it's not on the ovaries, right? It just depends of where it's located.
Yeah.
The ideal surgery, particularly for women of childbearing age who want, is to preserve the organs and right. just remove endometriosis itself only.
Do women tend to have the places it shows up for them? Or is it the kind of thing that it'll just spread and spread and spread? You know, do people, you know what I'm asking? Like somebody, you know, just gets endometriosis in one part of a cavity and it doesn't go crazy.
Sometimes, yeah, definitely it could. Sometimes not. And okay. also again, depends on their hormonal status. Are they under hormonal suppression? So they're suppressing the growth of the disease process.
Yeah.
So that would definitely affect it.
Okay.
And age can affect it. Pregnancies. It's a very complicated disease process. But yes, sometimes it can be days in one spot and it's small and doesn't travel. Other times it travels all the way to the diaphragm and you present with atelectasis to the ER. You know, just wow. I've seen everything.
Yeah. I mean, it just is kind of, it seems like it should be 10 different diseases, you know, because it shows up so many different ways.
That's exactly right. Yeah. One strong correlation is the pro-inflammatory state. So that's right. why I focus on anti-inflammatory diet, decreasing inflammation around the peripheral nerves and treating that myofascial spasm, which causes more inflammation.
Yeah. Okay. So is this preventable or minimizable through lifestyle choices, like an anti-inflammatory diet or, you know, you mentioned a genetic component. Is this something we're sort of destined to have, or are there things women can do to either prevent the symptoms or dramatically reduce them, you know, and maybe not need surgery or not get to that point?
Yeah. Again, just to reiterate, we are still learning in the medical about this disease process, but there, from the data, there is a strong genetic component. So, you know, in terms of completely preventing, I think it depends on how strong the genetics are there. Okay. You know, if it's both, you know, both grandparents and your mom and your aunt, you know, that, so there is a strong genetic component. So it's important to always ask that. It can be challenging because a lot of times, given the challenge in diagnosing, people say, I don't know, my mom had a hysterectomy, or but we don't know why. You know, they just
right.
That can be hard. But so that's for sure. But in terms of, you know, lifestyle modifications, I think, you know, they may help. They definitely, I see help with the pain, discomfort.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's huge, I think, right? Because we, you know, want to keep our patients having a great quality of life, having intercourse, keeping working and exercising and doing social things, all the great things they love. So definitely can affect your symptoms, you know, decreasing the inflammation as well. So we do talk a lot about, you know, diet, lifestyle modifications to help. And if it's bladder symptoms, very bladder forward, there's some, you know, different bladder diet things we talk about as well. So it is that holistic approach that we take at Pelvic Rehabilitation Medicine with endometriosis, given the complexity and systemic nature of the disease process.
Yeah. And is it known? I mean, I'm guessing no, but by how does this happen? I mean, I, you know, sort of back to the question I threw in with a whole bunch of them, like, do you think we all have these types of cells proliferate or, you know, in parts of our body and they just don't ever cause a problem? Or is something happening where these cells start to grow somewhere they just shouldn't? Do we know that? Like, how does this even, we don't know how this happens.
We do not know 100%. Yeah. I mean, the jury's still out. So there's some high level debates going on.
Yeah. Like so many things in sexual health, it's like, there's not enough research, right? Like, it's just so hard to know what we need to know about this.
All right. So hopefully this, all the great things you're doing with your podcast, right? You know, raising awareness, also research is one thing, but just for patients, we love to get them sooner. We feel so bad, you know, it's like people think they have to live with this and they just kind of deal with it.
Right.
Or, you know, because their MRI, you know, their ultrasound was normal and their blood work was normal, they were told they were crazy. Just have a glass of wine and relax and you'll be fine. You know, so we hear it every day still in 2021. So that's also really important. I think the more patients we get on board, then the stronger the patients, everyone unites. And I think we'll put more time and money into research, but awareness is the first step.
All right. So let's, maybe this is backtracking just a little bit, but if somebody's listening and thinking, wow, I have some pain with sex, you know, what should they be looking for, considering what should they pursue in terms of diagnosis or medical treatment? You mentioned an ultrasound or blood work, but like how, what signals that somebody might pursue, you know, at least rule out endometriosis?
Yeah. Signals would be, yep. Anything. Pain around intercourse, discomfort, it shouldn't hurt.
Of any kind, right? Like,
yeah, it shouldn't be uncomfortable. So okay. Any sort of discomfort anywhere, so, you know, post-intercourse soreness, entrance deep, any sort of discomfort, I would definitely, you know, tell your doctor. Any bladder symptoms, it's very common. Your urgency, frequency, burning, UTI yeah. sensations that just don't go away, and cultures are maybe positive one time, but even after antibiotics, you still have it. Very common. Bowel stuff. The most common place our endo patients start is with a GI doctor, actually.
Okay.
A lot of bloating, abdominal pain, constipation, pain with discomforts around bowel movements. Probably the most common symptom where our patients start seeing GI doctors and the workup's normal.
Okay.
And they're told IBS a lot of times, because that's just diagnosed when the workup's normal. A lot of times, most of our patients come with an IBS diagnosis.
Right. So let's say somebody's heard that. Okay. You must have IBS. How would they think then, wait, I need some other opinion about this. Maybe it's endo.
Oh, that's a great point. I mean, a lot of it comes when, you know, you start having intercourse or they start paying attention to maybe tampons are uncomfortable too. Okay. In addition.
Right. Cause IBS wouldn't do that. Right.
Gosh, I mean, a severe case could, but typically not.
Okay.
You know, you may want to look into your kind of family history, any moms, it's, you know, cousins, aunts, anyone
okay.
know, who's having similar symptoms. But yeah, I mean, if your GI doctor's not getting you anywhere, I would tell you, come see us at Pelvic Rehabilitation Medicine. We're in, you know, 13 different cities now and growing. So
okay.
we're close to a lot of different people. So the access is improving there. And then, or, you know, and or tell your gynecologist if your GI doctor's not, if it's not going away.
Right.
Maybe even just start with pelvic rehab medicine and some pelvic floor PT.
Yeah.
And if they respond, but just that, because sometimes pelvic floor dysfunction causes just GI, then we leave you. I mean, there's no sense going forward with anything else.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how we look at it. If you respond to our basic kind of outpatient comprehensive protocol, then we leave you.
Right. Right. And it does sound like also if people paid attention, it would ebb and flow with the menstrual cycle a little bit, like it would get worse. Like that would be another difference, it seems like, with IBS or something else.
Yeah, usually it does, or pre-menstrual cycle sometimes. That's
okay. What's,
it's not always during, sometimes before. But yes, they're usually at least at the beginning. What can be challenging is some patients really have a strong high pain threshold. So they really ignore it until it becomes a real problem. And then they don't really remember that cyclical nature.
Yeah.
So I've made that mistake before when I was first starting out, and I just thought, oh, it's not cyclical. So I made the wrong diagnosis for the patient, cause I was like, it's not cyclical. It can't be. And it was, I contributed to that delay, but now I'm understanding that more. That's what happens. Usually the cyclical can be subtle at the beginning. And if it's ignored, there's a, you know, a blurry line as to when it becomes kind of your normal.
Yeah.
Pelvic.
Right. Right. Okay. So talk just a little bit more about, you just said you're in 13 cities or something like that. Where do people find you? Where are you located? What would be a first step in people reaching out?
Sure. We're called Pelvic Rehabilitation Medicine, and it's pelvicrehabilitation.com is our website.
Okay.
So you can kind of look us up on our website. We're also on Instagram, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Pelvic Rehabilitation Medicine, and find out if we're anywhere near where you're located. So we'll be growing as well, just because there's such a need.
Yeah.
In the next year or so to more cities.
Okay. And then is there educational stuff on the website too? And you mentioned like the places to find really competent surgeons for this, things like, you know, other resources people would find there.
Yes, there's lots of resources on just understanding the different underlying disease processes, understanding the pelvic floor and et cetera. But yeah, for the surgeon specifically, it's on there too. But one's called I Care Better and the other one's called Nancy's Nook.
Okay.
Is on Facebook. Yeah. So it's just groups for that patients kind of go to find kind of vetted surgeons.
Right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. And it's still trying to wrap my head around all the different ways this presents and how complicated this is.
Yes, we all are.
Right.
So thank you for having me. Thank you so much for doing all this wonderful work for women. And I think it's so important what you're doing.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Better Sex. Please visit our website, bettersexpodcast.com, for show notes and additional episodes.
And that's a wrap for today. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. If you are enjoying the podcast, if some of this material resonates with you and you would like to make a difference and make sure that this keeps coming out in the world once a week, ongoing, there are a couple things you could do to show your appreciation. The first would be to go to iTunes and rate and review the show. That really helps us be found by new listeners when you review the show on iTunes. You can find a link at bettersexpodcast.com/iTunes. The other thing I want to invite you to consider is becoming a Patreon. For a small monthly pledge, you get some benefits. So for $2 a month, you get advance access to every single episode. For $5 a month, you get a chapter of my upcoming new book. And for $10 a month, I host quarterly get-to-know-you and question-and-answer chats over the web, and you get invited to that. I would love to have your membership in that become part of the Better Sex family. You can find a link at bettersexpodcast.com/Patreon, which is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Again, thanks for listening. I'm glad you're here. Feel free to comment, ask questions, get in touch. I'd love to hear from listeners. Thanks.